Blog Talk Radio.
Grace and peace be unto each and every one of you today from God our Father and from our Lord Jesus Christ. I am Archbishop Thomas Henry, and today you are listening to The Apostolic Voice. Today I just want to come to you for a few moments to just keep you abreast of what's going on around the Congress of Apostles and Bishops and our resources that we have available to you, so that you can get the right information, the proper information to help make sure that your ministry is on top, that your ministry does what it needs to do to be legitimate, your ministry does what it needs to do to be focused and on point, and all those other things. And one of the things that this year in our syllabus that we provided for the Congress, we dealt with, matter of fact, it starts on page 75 in the Congress syllabus for this year, and we dealt with it for a few pages, up until from page 75 to page 90, we have a whole section in the Congress syllabus, like we have in 2014, and then we did it in 2013 as well, that we dealt with church structure and legal issues, church structure and legal issues. This is an area in the body of Christ that sometimes our information is lacking. Our information is that's been given by some of our leaders have been off, and it has not been sufficient, if you will, to be able to meet the needs of the very people of God out there. And so we each year provide a syllabus where we deal with the issues that's facing the church, legally issue that faces the church, that we all as clergymen and women need to be aware of. And sometimes we get to a place where we say, well, that's not my concern. I'm not worried about what they think about what the government says. You know, they can't affect us because we the church, and what we do different from what the church does. Many times we get stuck on this little issue because despite our party persuasion, sometimes we get hooked on this thing that there in the United States there's a separation between church and state. And no matter where you stand, and even if you take this Baptist and Congregationalist point of view, there technically is no separation in the United States between church and state. I know some people argue with me against that, but if you look at the very history of our country, there's all church and state has always been intermingled. The only time people have issues with it when the church says something different from the government or the government says something different from the church, then you hear people start hollering, there's a separation between church and state. But this country has always had clergymen who were on his payroll. This country has always sanctioned churches. There is a church in Washington, D.C. right now that is sanctioned by the United States Congress. But that aside, that's not the issue of this particular broadcast. The issue of this particular broadcast is just to tell you about what we have in our 2015 syllabus as it relates to church structure and legal. Every year, as I said, every year, we put something in the syllabus that deals with church structure and legal, so that we as a people of God can be informed, properly informed, about what's going on. Because what do you know about the Congress is always legislating. The Congress changes the laws that the IRS enforces. The IRS does not make law, but they enforce the law, the tax law that the Congress makes. And the Congress does, from time to time, change the tax laws as it relates to the church. And the and not only that, but there have been laws that the that have come into being because of the courts. And so the Congress will legislate accordingly so that they can incorporate what the court says into its tax code as well as it relates to the church. And so in the 2015 syllabus, we lay out the pastor, his responsibility, the associate pastors and their responsibility, the board of elders. And what a board of elders, your governing board. Some of you in your churches call it a board of deacons. Some of you call it a board of directors or church council or board of trustees, finance committee, but every church needs a governing board, a board advisory board, a board that will assist the pastor as he leads the people of God and assists him in helping making those legal decisions. Matter of fact, there's a council a nonprofit council that actually is there to establish to help make churches and ministries more accountable. And one of the things that they insist on that every church, every parachurch ministry, have a board with at least, I think the last count, I think it was 5 members that was non-related to the pastor. And so even though every church, every state does not have that rule, every state, some states, you only need one person on the board. Some states you need a minimum of 3 on the board. Some states you need a minimum of 5 on the board. Some states is more than that. But the fact of the matter remains, if you are going to operate as a church, you need a board of directors. Even if you are a congregationally governed church, you need a board that runs the church in between congregational meetings. You need that. You need a board. We also talk about how you can give the pastor veto power over the board and still have checks and balances there and still be an independent church. And this is where we call episcopal and apostolic authority coming in and board of overseers. You can have a bishop and still be independent, even though that's kind of an oxymoron. But at the same token, there's some churches who don't want to be controlled, so to speak. And so they have a bishop, but they give them limited authority, board of overseers, and give them limited authority over their churches. And so we talk about that. We address that in the syllabus. Matter of fact, on page 78, it says, even an independent church need an episcopal or apostolic authority or a board of overseers as a measure of accountability to protect the church and to protect the pastor to help oversee the church and provide a measure of accountability. So every church needs a board of accountability. Then we talk about the diaconate, how it should function in the church. And one thing that I did in the early stages of our church, we employed, which is, because sometimes, you know, when you give the people, excuse me, when people give into your church, they want to know where their money goes. And legally speaking, you don't have to give them the minute details, but you do need to give them a report. And so what we did at my church, we did at Christian Life, we started it in the early days of the church. We gave a financial annual church report. And in this particular 2015 syllabus, we described what should be in your annual church report. We talk about why you need a church report and why it's so important, what you should put in there to show. Every year, your church should give out to its members or make available to its member an annual church report that states the mission of the church. It should have a letter from the pastor. It should talk about the major accomplishment and achievements of the church. It should report on the new initiatives of the church, the outreach, building improvement, staff expansion, etc. This annual report should highlight features and personal stories of individuals volunteering or helping or serving in various areas of ministries, evangelism, missions, education, liturgy, service to the poor, and etc. There should also be in this report parish or church demographics. It should talk about the number of families that are involved in the church. It should describe the baptisms, how many baptisms, how many funerals, new members, weddings, and what have you. If you had any members of that local congregation that was ordained in that season, then that also, too, should be mentioned in the annual church report. Very important, very important, very important. A lot of times people don't give to your churches because they don't know where things are going. And the annual church report is a great way to talk about what's going on in the church, what's being planned in the church, and what can be done to facilitate more growth in the church and to actually increase the income of the church. An annual church report can do that. Annual church report also should state the parish financials. You don't have to be specific, but you should break it down in categories and talk about, you know, to talk about what's going on in the annual church report. There's other things that we talk about in this. We detail we go in more details about the pastor and the elders and the financial committee in this book. We talk about the bank accounts because a lot of times, even though your pastor may be the person with the juridic authority in the church, your pastor should not be the only signatory on the church accounts. The treasurer as well as some other officers should be on the church accounts. All church accounts should use the church tax identification number, not just the social security number of the leader of that church. All church organizations should issue a report to the pastor and the church council based on the financial needs of each event or as requested. You know, that the church account. The church should have 50,000 accounts. I know that's an exaggeration, but that some of the time, a lot of you, your churches have multiple bank accounts instead of having one general bank account, and that general bank account is divided into other accounts. Now, there's nothing wrong with having investments accounts that the church may have, nothing wrong with having savings account and escrow accounts and stuff like that. But it is actually, and I have to actually look up that law again, but churches should not have a whole bunch, multiples. When I said multiple, I'm talking about multiple accounts, like account for this business, a building fund, a separate building fund account, or maybe a general fund account. It should have a lot of accounts because it starts to look suspicious. And that should be a general fund account. If there are other accounts, those accounts can be established for those ministries or departments who are separate from the church but operate under covering of the church. But a church should not have multiple accounts. That does not mean that you can't have investments accounts, like I said, savings accounts and all that. But, you know, you got some churches, they have a general fund account, and their general fund account is almost broke, but then they have a separate bank account for the youth ministry, and that got thousands of dollars in it. They have a separate account for their building fund. It has thousands of dollars in there, and it never get touched. You got some churches, they've been raising building fund for years, and their building fund never, ever get touched. But yet the general fund is lacking, and many times it runs in the red. And then you have people that guard these other little accounts like they're gods. But the church should not have multiple bank accounts. They should have a general account where most of these other funds are placed into. And it should be, and if they have the right people to budget these accounts, then you'll know what funds has money, what funds don't have money, and then whether you have to borrow money from those other funds that are in the same account, and money that should be paid back into those accounts as well. Notice I said one general fund account, but that general fund bank account also has the building fund in it, has this other stuff in it as well. Every pastor should be on a contract. I mentioned this one time before on Facebook, and I had some crazy preachers try to argue me down. But they don't realize, legally speaking, you may went out and started the church, but until there is a formal relationship established between you and your ministry, you technically are preaching at it, but you ain't technically legally the pastor of it because there has never been any formal relationship established. Sometimes people start a church and they never have an installation service. They never have official service where they are officially installed as the pastor of that particular church. But yet and still, they say, I'm the pastor. And all that, you didn't make me the pastor. Well, they may not have made you the pastor, but you're not officially the pastor. And legally speaking, you have never been elected or chosen as the pastor. You just went out and started something. So you need to sit down with the leaders of your church and establish a formal relationship between you and your church. And if you have not already done that, you can do it and do it retroactively back to the day that you first started your church. It may just take you sitting down with your board of directors or whatever your church board is called, having a meeting, and officially retroactively establish that as of this date, you started this church, and as of this date, these people agreed to accept you as the pastor of your church, and on this particular day, we acknowledge that fact that you started this church and that you are the pastor of this church, and that this church recognizes that legal relationship which you started retroactively back to the date that you started the church. Very important, brothers and sisters. And I said again, very important, because if you go to court, if you have any legal challenges arise, you need to have a paper trail that establishes your legal relationship. Your legal relationship with that organization. Each church, for their pastor, should have a contract entered into between the church and the pastor, and if you have a bishop, if it requires stating the relationship between them and the pastor, and when his ministry starts, the length of service, amount that he will be paid, and when. Even if you don't have the money to pay your pastor, you still need to have a contract that states all of this stuff. This is very important, because sometimes we don't have the money to pay our pastors a regular salary, but then again, we have these anniversary services where we raise them thousands of dollars. And legally speaking, that can be called an excessive benefit when you don't have a contract established. Tells what happens in the case that you have programs like that, how the funds would be allocated. Would part of the funds go to the church and the rest of it would be part of the pastor deemed as a salary and all of that? And so all of this need to be covered. Also, as it relates to pastor, his love offerings and anniversary offerings, should how that's going to be handled. It should be stated in the contract, monies for his ministry trip, how that would be handled. If he go out and preach at a church, do we have to pay that money over to the church, and then the church gives him a check for the amount of the money that he got as an honorarium at those other engagements? All this stuff should be handled. The pastor payroll taxes, because the pastor has a dual relationship with the church, because usually you give the pastor a W-2 as though he's an employee, but the pastor is considered for tax purposes independent, usually is considered to be self-employed, and therefore he pays his own Social Security tax unless the church elects to pay that for the pastor. So all of this need to be handled. And even if you, trust me, even if your church is a small church and you don't have the funds to pay for your pay a salary, you need to put a contract down on paper. There need to be some contract down on paper that creates a paper trail for how your pastor will be blessed and how your pastor will receive money from your church. Trust me, that is very important. That will keep you out of courts. Not only will it keep you out of courts, but it will keep your pastor on point when it comes to the IRS and with the tax laws as it relates to the pastors receiving money from their church. Very, very important. Every year, at the beginning of your church year, your church need to approve a housing allowance for your pastor, a utility allowance, an auto allowance, health benefits, and retirement. Especially, you need to be abreast with the new laws with Obamacare and all of that. You need to put in the package, how will his vacation time work? Is he responsible for covering the pulpit in his absence, or does he allow the church to cover the pulpit? And who will pastor for him? Can the board meet when he is on vacation? All of this stuff need to be covered. Whether every 3 or 5 years, will the pastor be on a paid sabbatical from the church? All of this is important to the church. Very important. Very important. And we did this in the 2015 syllabus for the Congress of Apostles and Bishops. We talk about how to plan a church. We go through in the syllabus 10 points in planting a church. I posted those before on Facebook several times for the benefit of those that needed it. We talk about what is ordination, and we answer the question on page 82 of this syllabus. Can one lose their ordination? Is once ordained always ordained? And we talk about that this is not legally true in every situation. I know we got a lot of people who try to over-spiritualize everything and say, well, I'm ordained and can't nobody take that from me but God. Well, you ain't read the Bible. Because if you read the Bible, you can see what God told Moses before Aaron died, Aaron had to be defrocked. His vestments had to be removed and placed on another. So Aaron technically was defrocked, even though he did not sin, but before he could die, he had his vestments removed. That's what the word defrocked means, to remove the vestments. And so, yes, ordination do not last always. Ordination. I know some of you may come from the Catholic tradition where it said once a priest, always a priest. But even then, they still tell you that a priest can be laitized, which means even though they're a priest, they can be returned to the lay state. They don't stop being a priest. They are just relieved of the faculties to operate as a priest. Now, the only thing they can operate, unless in case of emergency, they can operate then when there's no priest. But outside of those emergency, they can only be act like a layman. So yes, you're not always ordained. And then if your church ceases to exist, technically speaking, your paperwork ceases to exist as well. If your fellowship ceases to exist, that means that your paperwork ceases to exist as well, unless your fellowship or reformation was absorbed into, or merged into, or taken over by another organization. Then that means that your credentials will be transferred from the old body to the succeeding body. So we talk about all of that. So it's not once ordained, always ordained. Solomon loses 10 tribes to Jeroboam. Judas loses his apostleship, and Matthew takes his place. Saul loses his kingdom to David. Elijah is told to train his successor and do no more miracles except the parting of the water of the River Jordan. Samson didn't know the glory had departed from him, and that he had been fired by God, yet God did give him a second chance. And so there is, in the Bible, evidence of clergy being defrocked, undressed, or the gown or the vestments removed, thus removing them from office. And so we talk about a lot of other stuff in this syllabus. This syllabus is a great syllabus. We talk about the 501c3 and other related IRS issues that a lot of people don't understand. When it relates to 501c3, and I'm speaking, I said it's very plain so nobody missed this. Because sometimes we hear stuff, but then we don't hear stuff because of what we call confirmation bias. All churches, according to the IRS code, all churches are automatically considered tax exempt, whether they file for official recognition or not, whether they are incorporated or not. See, you got a lot of people, I don't want to incorporate because if I incorporate, I become 501c3 and I'm controlled by the government. Actually, that's ignorance because whether you are incorporated or not, no matter what country you're in, every country has the right to make laws for its people. And every country has made laws as it relates to what the religious institution can or cannot do in their country. And despite we say in this country that they supposedly quote that there's a separation of church and state, the Congress has regulated what the church can and cannot do. And then some of your local state governments have said where churches can't sit at and where clubs can't sit up as it relates to the proximity to the churches. And there's some communities which have begun to keep their churches out of storefronts, have regulated what kind of building churches can go into. And that if they get a building that is a storefront, certain things they have to do to bring it up to code, or they can't get in the building to stay in the building. So that the government has always been legislating rules that fit the church. One major proof of this, that there is a fictitious line between church and state, is the Mormon church. When Utah was trying to be admitted to the Union, the Congress was trying to get the Mormon Church and the Utah territory to cease polygamy. They were strong and adamant about maintaining their quote-unquote religious liberty to practice their faith how they wanted to, which included polygamy. So the Congress passed an act that seized the property and bank accounts and finances of the Mormon Church, which at that time probably totaled about $300,000 to $400,000. And they said, we will not release this until you get rid of polygamy. And then somehow or another, the Mormon prophet had a revelation. And he had a revelation that polygamy is not needed, is not a necessary act at the moment for godhood, or all the doctrines in the Mormon church. And then Utah, the Congress released the funds and the property of the church. And not only that, but what Congress did do, and the church and the Mormon church had to wind up redoing what they did, that Congress disincorporated the Mormon church. And so later on, the Mormon church never reincorporated as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but they incorporated themselves as two different corporations. One corporation was the corporation for the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and the other one was the corporation for the presiding bishop of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So whether you're incorporated or not, Congress, your local state, your local government can make laws that affect you. So it's real crazy to say, well, we ain't going to incorporate that because we become a legal entity of the state when we incorporate. Do you realize that your state also has nonprofit, unincorporated nonprofit association laws that your church should abide by as well? Yeah, they didn't tell you that, did they? Sure do. Churches are subject to the state. Not-for-profit corporation laws, if incorporated, if the church is unincorporated, it is subject to that state unincorporated not-for-profit corporation laws. Churches are liable to pay employment taxes, maintain insurance to include liability and malpractice insurance on clergy. You should not counsel your members without having insurance on your church and on your pastor. That's very important, very, very important. Payroll, a lot of times some of you pay your musicians in cash. But your musicians should not be paid in cash. Your musicians should not be paid out of petty cash. Your musicians for your church should be paid out of checks or money order or direct deposits or debit cards only. Your church should have employment policies in place. People should be paid no later than 14 days after the end of their pay period or sooner based on the laws of your state. Check with your local Department of Labor to determine your state employment policies as it relates to when paychecks should be paid. Musicians, if they play for you on a regular basis, are considered employees of your church and not independent contractors, even if they're not members of your church. But if they play for your church on a regular basis, they are considered to be employees and not independent contractors and should not be given a 1099, but be given a W-2. You need to have them fill out you need to get a W-9, and you need to do all those other things filled out for them so you can do the proper withholding for those musicians. Guest speakers, singers, and musicians should fill out a W-9 form. If they receive more than $600 for their services, they should be provided a form 1099 for their services as well. We are about out of time for this particular broadcast, but like I said, in the Congress syllabus, we cover a lot of things. We cover, like I said, the 501c3. We tell you what you need to put inside your documents for 501c3. We also cover the marriage laws because some people have issues with same-sex marriage and how to deal with it. So we talk about the marriage laws and how to what to put inside your documents to provide for that. We talk about a pastoral succession plan and what should be done to properly deal with that. We talk about pastoral love offering, houses allowance, and properly documented pastoral salary. We deal with that. We talk about watch your activities because some churches, they are making money in what we call unrelated business income. And don't you know, unrelated business income can get a church in trouble. It can get a church, people paying for their guest speakers for meals, and they're not properly documented. Cribs and baby nursery, board meetings, social pastors. We cover a lot of things in the 2015 syllabus. And I promise you, there's a lot of information here. And all that. So we talk about Social Security and Medicaid taxes that are collected. And we talk about the pastors and what system they are under. We talk about how to report love offerings. So there's a lot of legal stuff in the syllabus. For the past 30 minutes, you have been listening to the Apostolic Voice, And I have been Archbishop Thomas, and go to our website, COAAB.org. Get our 2015 syllabus. Get our books. We have plenty of books available online. God bless you. You have a great and prosperous afternoon.